I would liken it to a legislative time bomb. They're going to set this bomb in statute, and they're going to light a 2-year fuse on it.
The state Senate prepares to vote on a bill that would ban marijuana concentrates. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 27th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, the unpleasant math that makes Alaska's budget problem so tough.
You simply cannot cut your way to a sustainable budget.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The men and women of Public Employees Local 71 maintain over 20,000 miles of roads and runways and cook and care for those in Alaska's pioneer homes. Public Employees Local 71, working hard for Alaska, working hard for you. This message is sponsored by Public Employees Local 71.
The Alaska Senate has delayed a vote on its signature marijuana bill after saying they need more time to consider an amendment that would largely ban concentrates. Senator Pete Kelly, a Fairbanks Republican, said a drafting issue with his amendment caused the holdup. The measure gives marijuana concentrates like hash oil and edibles the felony treatment, but includes an exception for concentrates meant for medicinal use. Because the Constitution bans the legislature from tampering with ballot initiatives for 2 years after they go into effect, the ban on concentrates would not start until 2017. Kelly says he's offering the amendment now to send a message to the nascent marijuana industry.
To have them spend money on display cases and processing and all that stuff, inventory, only to have it be illegal 2 years from now. This way it says before you even start investing, this particular part of your business is going to be illegal. I didn't think it was fair to the people who might be investing.
This is Kelly's second attempt to ban concentrates through the marijuana bill. The measure was briefly adopted during the committee process, but was removed after an outcry that it went against the spirit of the initiative. Bruce Schulte is with the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation, and he lobbies on behalf of the marijuana industry. He describes the amendment as a, quote, preemptive repeal of the ballot measure.
I would liken it to a legislative time bomb. They're going to set this bomb in statute, and they're going to light a 2-year fuse on it, and they're trying to guarantee that a legitimate marijuana industry will not develop. It cannot, because nobody's going to go into business when they know that their entire business model is going to crumble on February 24th, 2017.
The amendment and the full marijuana bill is scheduled for a vote on Monday. A standing room only crowd gathered yesterday in the Capitol to watch a special budget presentation that had been discussed in murmurs for weeks. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports that the outlook for the state was somewhere between gloomy and apocalyptic.
The legislative finance director's model illustrated what he had long been saying.
You simply cannot cut your way to a sustainable budget.
Manipulating a spreadsheet with dozens of inputs, David Teal showed what would happen if the state cut formula programs, added a variety of taxes, and shrunk its agencies. None of the actions taken on their own made any difference. At projected oil prices, the state still doesn't close its multi-billion dollar deficit. Teal played with one scenario where the legislature cut its budget by 12% each year until the state's billion-dollar education program was shrunk to a third of what it is now. When the model continued to show a deficit, you could hear the audience muttering, "Wow." House Finance Co-Chair Steve Thompson had to stop Teal at another scenario. Whole agency operations were shut down in this one, and still, the state faced a shortfall.
Meaning no state troopers, no DOT.
No corrections, no prisons, no
prison guards,
correct.
All of those.
Yeah. But of course that isn't workable.
The only scenario that seemed to make any difference was one where the state cut spending, oil prices rose some, a modest income tax was implemented, and the state drew some money from the permanent fund earnings reserve while paying out a potentially smaller dividend. That account is separate from the permanent fund's principal, and legislators can draw on it at any point with a simple majority vote. However, the fund is a third rail, and rarely discussed because of its political consequences. That was illustrated halfway through the presentation when Senator Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, logged onto Twitter from his phone and accused the Republican House majority of making moves to raid the permanent fund. He elaborated on the comment after the presentation.
When you talk about raiding the permanent fund, what you're talking about is taking money out of the earnings reserve and using it for government expenses or using it for something else other than paying out dividends.
Thompson, who sponsored the Lunch and Learn, responded with some annoyance to the suggestion.
We're not raiding the permanent fund. I mean, and nobody's going to do that. I mean, I don't see how that's even a possibility. But we've got to have the discussion on about how can we fund the core services that are expected under our Constitution by the citizens of Alaska.
The Fairbanks Republican said the purpose of the presentation, which came from a nonpartisan analyst, was to give the public a better understanding of the state's fiscal outlook. The model had already been shown to many lawmakers and some staff, but with only a few weeks of session to go, had not been public until now. Representative Les Guerra, another Anchorage Democrat who was in attendance, said he did find value in seeing the hard numbers, even if he would have liked to see more attention to the effect different policies on oil taxes and credits have on the state budget.
I think it's worthwhile to have over and over and over again for the public to see all over the state so they can plug in numbers. Look, if they're oil tax people, they can say, what would oil tax changes do? If they believe in other sources of revenue, they could plug in those numbers. But I think it's important to lead to an honest public discussion.
The Walker administration also had at least one member present. Tax Division Director Ken Alper said he thought the presentation captured the urgency of the state's budget situation. He added that the executive branch is working on its own model as it figures out the next step in tackling the revenue shortfall. But he stressed that for now, the focus is simply on cutting the budget. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Lawmakers took public testimony for the first time yesterday on Governor Bill Walker's bill to expand Medicaid. The public spoke during the last 30 minutes of the House Health and Social Services Committee's hearing on HB 148. Nearly everyone spoke in favor of Medicaid expansion. The committee heard from a youth pastor, a small business owner, and the head of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Juneau resident Allison Curry told the committee she's a social worker who too often sees clients who have to make do without health care.
It is an injustice to me that today, if you are a childless adult without a disability in Alaska, making less than $20,000 a year, which equals to just under $10 an hour, you have no affordable health care coverage available to you.
The House Health and Social Services Committee plans to spend a lot more time taking public testimony on Medicaid expansion at a committee hearing this Saturday, starting at 3 p.m. Most local legislative information offices will be open around the state to allow people to testify outside of Juneau. Environmentalists are saying a budget amendment authored by Senator Lisa Murkowski could lead to a plundering of treasured federal landscapes. Murkowski's amendment on federal land disposals was part of a national budget resolution the Senate passed early this morning. Senators offered hundreds of amendments that don't have the force of law, but often serve symbolic or political purposes. Murkowski said on the Senate floor her amendment could facilitate state and local land exchanges to create balanced resource policy. But the senator says the amendment doesn't, on its own, sell or exchange any particular piece of federal land.
Any legislation enabled by the Spending Neutral Reserve Fund will have to go through the process and be voted either up or down in regular order. But the language does specify what cannot be considered, and that's any land that's located within a national park, within a national preserve, or a national monument. So those will continue to be protected.
The Alaska Wilderness League Conservation Director Kristen Miller says Murkowski's amendment leaves refuges, national forests, and other lands vulnerable.
You know, the way the legislation reads, it's targeted at every single one of our public lands across the country that didn't fall into the categories explicitly listed. So it's dangerous everywhere from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge down to, you know, the bottom of Florida.
Miller says it's not clear what the implications are for the non-binding measure.
It's hard to say. I mean, the amendment was brought to the floor. It was voted on. The way you read it, it seems to encourage for our public lands to be given away, to be transferred, and to be potentially up for sale for development.
The Senate approved it after Murkowski held the vote open for an extra 10 minutes and convinced Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine to change her vote. Collins told the publication Environment and Energy Daily she voted for it because Murkowski assured her any future land exchanges would have to come before Congress. The budget resolution itself passed with just 52 votes. It is not law, but serves as a blueprint for the appropriations process. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, jousting, feasting, and dressing up like a king, all in the name of recreating the Middle Ages.
An anachronism is something out of its place and time. I think everybody here would say that that explains who they are.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The University of Alaska Southeast has more online learning programs than any other university in Alaska. UAS is a learning community where your professors are mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
The Alaska Court of Appeals has affirmed a lower court's decision that Yupik fishermen who fished during a state closure should be charged. The decision was issued today. In 2012, the 13 defendants, all Yupik Alaska Native fishermen living a subsistence lifestyle, were convicted of violating the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's emergency orders restricting fishing for king salmon on the Kuskokwim River. The defendants moved for dismissal on the charges, asserting that their fishing for king salmon was a religious activity and that they were entitled to a religious exemption from the emergency orders under the Free Exercise Clause of the Alaska Constitution. The district court said that the state's responsibility to protect the declining species of fish outweighed the men's claim of religious rights. Attorneys for the Yupik fishermen plan to appeal the case to the Alaska Supreme Court. This week's warm weather is turning attention to river breakup. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum is tracking the factors that play into ice flowing out.
Basically, from Fairbanks eastward, it's been kind of a more typical winter, at least when you look at the ice thicknesses and the snowpack on the ground, versus, you know, further to our west and south. As you go into the western interior, the snowpack is well below normal, and this is the same case as you go south of the Alaska Range.
Plum says above normal snowpack in the Canadian Yukon will send a lot of water into the upper Yukon River, but a forecasted trend of warm days and cool nights should meter the influx and promote a gradual breakup. Plum says ice thickness going into spring are, as usual, variable.
Most of the lakes are running a little bit above normal thicknesses, whereas some of the river sites are a little bit below normal.
That was the case on the Tanana River at Nenana at the beginning of March. But Nenana Ice Classic manager Sherry Forness says this week's ice measurement of 35 inches was closer to the norm for this time of year.
I think it's a pretty average year.
Breakup timing has a lot to do with weather, and the thermometer pushed 50 degrees in recent days.
We are having, you know, extremely warm temperatures, and so we're thinking that the ice will most likely go out early.
Forness says the earliest the ice has ever gone out on the Nenana is April 20th. Last year, the tripod tipped on April 25th. Ice Classic tickets remain for sale through April 5th. A South African adventurer pedaled a bike into Fairbanks this week, completing the first leg of a journey that will take him around the world twice over 8 years. KUAC's Dan Bross reports on the human-powered journey.
Angelo Wilkie Page began his trip in Los Angeles last November, cycling over 6,000 kilometers to Fairbanks through sometimes extreme conditions.
Minus 40 degrees in the Yukon, but it's been absolutely beautiful.
After a few days in Fairbanks, Wilkie Page headed home to South Africa with plans to fly back to Fairbanks and resume his journey in early June, first paddling a kayak down the Chena, Tanana, and Yukon rivers.
And I'll get to the river mouth and then paddle up the coast of Alaska to Nome and Wales. And then from Wales, I'll shoot across the Bering Strait to Russia.
The longer-range plan calls for Wilkie Page to cycle across Russia and Europe, row across the Atlantic to Brazil, then bike north and begin a second global circumnavigation, this time in the unprecedented north-south direction.
No one has ever completed a successful pole-to-pole human-powered circumnavigation.
Wilkie Page is using the project called Expedition 720 to try to break round-the-world records, as well as to generate donations for Heifer International South Africa, a nonprofit organization that helps communities develop sustainable agriculture. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
As Iditarod mushers were finishing their 1,000-mile journey, a family of four was just beginning their own trek from under the ceremonial burled arch. KNOM's Kristen Leffler has the story.
Brett Wood, or Hig Higman, Aaron McKittrick, and their two young kids, Katmai and Latuya, started their 500-mile trek from Nome to Kotzebue on Friday. Over the next few months, they plan to walk, ski, and paddle up the Bering Strait.
Planning to head out around the coast and visit all the villages along the way and then end up in Kotzebue.
We have, for instance, pack rafts that right now we're putting skids on and going to be using as sleds, but we expect we'll actually be paddling in them at some point, or at least have that possibility. We've got the kids have skis, and we can put these little things on top of them to make them into kick sleds, and they can also ride in the raft sled, or they can walk. So we've got all these different possibilities that hopefully some combination of those will make for a fun, successful trip.
Aaron and Hig met in college in Minnesota and soon got hooked on long-distance trekking. In 2007, they trekked 4,000 miles from Seattle to the Aleutian Islands, spending over a year in the wilderness. After having kids, they thought they'd have to put those long treks aside for a while. But instead, their 6-year-old and 4-year-old come along for the journeys.
We did a few little trips, though, with the kids, and actually even when Aaron was pregnant with Katmai and such, and started to say, you know, this is really quite possible, and thinking about the fact that historically, like, people traveled and did all kinds of incredible things with kids.
And it's a learning experience for all of them. Hig and Aaron have backgrounds in geology and molecular biology, respectively, and their expeditions allow them to see climate change right before their eyes.
Going around Alaska right now and looking at the effects of climate change, you can go out and be in places where you're seeing changes that are happening on human timescales, that over just a few years, landscapes changing, rivers moving, new plants coming in, glaciers retreating, all of this stuff is happening really, really fast.
Through blogs, books, and films, they hope to share their observations to help educate people about the effects of climate change. This time, they're really interested in learning about sea ice changes, and they are always looking to learn from the people they meet along the way. Reporting in Nome, I'm Kristen Leffler.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University offers working professionals courses designed to fit their busy lifestyles. With hybrid online and in-person classes, the MBA at APU is an accelerated, affordable, and high-quality pathway to career advancement. Learn more by calling 800-252-7528 or visiting alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Matt Martin. This week on AK, the Middle Ages. Feasts, jousting, and medieval dresses are just your average afternoon for members of the Society for Creative Anachronism. Participants are dedicated to researching and recreating the arts and culture of pre-17th century Europe. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver joined the Alaska contingent for its annual bi-baronial collegium in Wasilla and reports it's about values, family, and finding a place to fit in.
Once upon a time in the Kingdom of the West, there was a great leather worker named Gregor Hawk. He was known across the land for making the strongest and most beautiful leather armor. One day, he decided to teach others his craft. In March of the 49th year of the Society for Creative Anachronism, he led a belt-making workshop.
I'll go ahead and rivet one.
Gregor is showing his students how to attach the buckle. Gregor's from the Principality of Owertha, or Alaska, as it's known in the mundane or modern world, where he also goes by the name Michael Snyder. He's a member of the SCA. It's a reenactment society with thousands of members worldwide. Local groups like this one meet as often as they can to celebrate medieval times. Gregor's hands deftly work the leather. The passion that shows in his work also comes out when he talks about the SCA. He first joined 25 years ago after going to a Renaissance fair.
My best friend, his high school coach in wrestling, was out there fighting, you know, dressed up in armor and everything. We're like, wow. And we've known the guy for years and we had no idea he was into this. And it was hook, line, and sinker. As soon as we saw him hit each other with a sword the very first time, we were like, this is what we want to do.
Lilla of Sheeprock is helping the fighters suit up in full armor.
I'm from the Barony of Wintersgate, the Principality of Owertha, Kingdom of the West. My mundane name is Michelle Webb. I live in Fairbanks, Alaska.
She's been in the SCA for more than a decade.
Originally, the attraction was all the things that you imagine, princesses and sword fights and all of that kind of great stuff that you really want to do when you're 8 years old. And finally, there were grown-ups doing it. It was so exciting. And it's still that exciting.
The SCA is based on the feudal system of medieval Europe. The known world is broken up into kingdoms, like the West, which includes California, Alaska, parts of East Asia, and more, then principalities, like Alaska, baronies, like Fairbanks, and so on. Each has its own nobles, knights, and craftspeople.
In the society, instead of creating a character like you would in a game, you create a persona, which is what I think best described as a medieval version of yourself.
We are the Society for Creative Anachronism. An anachronism is something out of its place and time. I think everybody here would say that that explains who they are.
Marjorie de Fairfield, or Tina Smith, is a baronial chronicler. She's also an accomplished calligrapher who handwrites and illuminates most of the official documents for the Alaskan SCA. She says the society doesn't try to exactly recreate the past, but reimagines it. They keep the exciting parts of medieval life, like chivalry and dancing, and leave out the bad parts, like the plague.
Doesn't everybody want to escape from their life and live in a better place? I mean, they talk about heaven being a better place, but we can't get there till we're done with this life. I'm not done with this life yet.
That seems to be the heart of SCA. It's where people go to find their place. Gregor Hawk says his life before the SCA was very different.
It's kind of a sad story. Like, my dad was really abusive, beat up on my mom and everyone a lot. And, you know, I didn't really know how to trust anybody. I didn't know how to love and things like that. All I knew was fear. You know, fear and hate and hopelessness. Like, I probably wouldn't be here right now without the society.
Through the society, Gregor found a new family and a creative outlet. Stories like his are common among SCA members. Many credit the society with getting their lives back on track and using the past to get to a better future.
Everything is about everybody else. You know, we try to elevate each other. And in that, we get our gratification and stuff. You know, knowing you're a part of a bigger story, helping somebody achieve goals and stuff like that. If you're supporting everybody and they're supporting everybody, then you've got hundreds of people on your side helping you. And that's what I like about the SCA, and I wish I could see that more in the real world.
Gregor says that's why he'll continue on as a leather worker, as a fighter, and why he hopes to someday be King of the West to help lead others down the same path.
Oh yeah, I'll die of old age. You know, I'll be here to the very bitter end.
And then Gregor Hawk will be able to say he did live happily ever after. For AK, I'm Shady Grove Oliver in Wasilla.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we hear from a Filipino high school student who moved to Pilot Station from Texas with his family when he was a first grader.
I'm Dana Storr. We first moved to Alaska back in 2005. My mom got accepted to be a math and science teacher in Pilot Station, a secondary math and science teacher. And I was in first grade at that time. And I can still remember my first impressions. I thought, man, it's so cold here. It's so different than it was like in the city. It took a while for me to get used to because I wasn't used to seeing any small stores because I got used to shopping in malls with my aunts and my friends and my parents. Over the years, I've got to know the culture and the way of life of the Yupiks, and I still miss being in Pilot. We moved to Mountain Village last summer, and it's still getting a while to get used to because the people are different there and they have different dialects, so yeah. After I completed my standards for Yupik, I forgot how to speak it, but this year, now that I'm in conversational Yupik, I'm learning how to speak. After graduating, I want to be attending college in University of Alaska Anchorage here and do computer engineering, or major in computer engineering, because I'm really into changing computer parts and stuff like that.
49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to share your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Shady Grove Oliver, Ann Hillman, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Matt Martin.
And that's it for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Kristen Leffler in Nome. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ann Hillman. Have a fantastic weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Premier Dental Group. The Smiles for Life Foundation helps fund children's charities and humanitarian work. Learn more at smilealaska.com.
And by
Raven Alaska, connecting Alaskans across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com. The University of Alaska Southeast has programs in business, arts and sciences, education, and career education. UAS is a learning community where your professors are mentors and friends on campus and online. uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. The 2015 PFD filing season is here. If you have questions about your absences or someone you know away at college or serving in the military, the State of Alaska Department of Revenue encourages you to be proactive. Check out the absence guidelines before applying for your PFD. Visit pfd.alaska.gov and click on eligibility in the banner to learn more. The deadline to apply is March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.